Collector's Item by Eddie Robson. What do you give the man who has everything for Christmas? That's the problem with Irving Braxiatel. When he wants something, he goes straight out and gets it. Sometimes, when he decides he wants something, it immediately arrives in the post, because his future self will track it down, go back in time and send it to himself at the moment he wanted it. The ultimate in instant gratification. But this year, I remembered something that happened quite a few years ago, back before I started working on the Braxiatel collection, and I thought maybe there was something I could give him after all. I was part of a small survey team on Wanus Amata, a smallish but very lush planet in the Piatek system. It was one of those corporate jobs. We'd been hired by Anderson Lee Stractify to identify sites of potential archaeological interest and ring-fence them before the company sent in their drones to suck the place dry. Now, I was under no illusions. Those jobs are always depressing. However pleasant the company are to your face, never forget they're doing the survey because the law says they have to, and every time you ring-fence anything, they will challenge it. Sometimes you have to pick your battles and make some grim compromises, but if you give them too much trouble, they'll fire you and bring in another team who gives them the answers they like. And so it was on Wanus Amata. ALS were already mining the Lucanol-rich deserts around the equator. They'd had those sites surveyed already. I'd been drafted in because the next area, the forest of the southern hemisphere, was larger and more challenging, and they needed extra people on the team. Many of the trees were over 100 meters tall, and even with drones mapping and scanning, it was too big for 16 people to survey thoroughly. But the budget ALS had provided for the survey didn't stretch to more than that. The man in charge of the team was Professor Lucas Chilwell, and I had my doubts about his integrity. During the desert survey, he'd ring-fenced a few token areas and let ALS have the run of the rest. He told me they didn't expect to find much anyway, because the academic consensus was that there had never been intelligent life on Wanus Amata. It had an atmosphere that was just about breathable for humans, but not comfortably so, and there was no evidence of a civilization. But to me, that sounded a lot like what ALS wanted to hear. I didn't trust Chilwell to fight my corner if I found anything and the company challenged it. These people only really listen to money. So before I even got there, I fired off a message to the richest person I knew. It was lonely work. With so few of us, we were spread out and working almost exclusively with drones, and the drones' personality settings were very limited. Obviously, we were supposed to get on with our work, not chat to the drones. But the team were a good bunch. I enjoyed hanging out with them back at the camp complex in the evenings, and the planet itself was fascinating. I could see why ALS wanted to get their hands on the forest. The huge trees were made of something malleable, almost like plastic. With very little processing, it would be ideal to use in large-scale printing. But the forest was also teeming with life, including a species of what looked a little like bipedal tigers. Vicious and impossible to communicate with, but very impressive creatures nonetheless. We wore encounter suits that hid us from their vision, and if we stayed still, they went away. I did wonder what kind of environmental survey ALS had done. Maybe there was no intelligent life here now, but if the planet got hollowed out and all the forests cut down, there seemed little chance of it ever evolving. Did they have a sustainable deforestation scheme? Somehow, I doubted it. Based on soil analysis and sonic imaging, I logged 18 sites as suitable for further exploration, but there really wasn't much to go on. If there had been a civilization here, it must be well buried now. Which made the thing I found in the middle of my third week all the more surprising. The trees shielded it from aerial view, but on the ground, you couldn't miss it. In a clearing stood 6 outbuildings, each of slightly different size and design, and in the centre of them was a tall, crumbling cylindrical tower with a series of circular windows around the top which seemed to have been shuttered or boarded up. It looked like it was made of stone. The outbuildings were empty. Probably they'd once been stables or used for storage. But the tower housed something extraordinary. I thought perhaps it was a sculpture, but like nothing I'd ever seen. It was as if panes of glass had been dropped from the ceiling and then frozen in time just before the first of them hit the floor. I couldn't see how they were suspended or fixed together. They seemed to intersect at various points. But the structure didn't look like it could possibly support itself. And when you got very close, there seemed to be a barrier that stopped you actually touching it. I added footage of it to the team's group chat, and everyone dropped what they were doing to come and see. Most of them were excited. Some of them were obviously irritated that I was the new girl on the team and I'd basically found a small castle while they were still hoping for a shard of pottery. Chilwell, to be fair, was thrilled. He scampered from one end of the site to the other, talking about applying for a grant to study it, said I could be on the team. We could co-author research papers, even a documentary. The rep from ALS arrived, a woman called Lita, and I half expected her to accuse us of building it ourselves on the sly, since their satellite survey seemed to have missed it entirely. But she seemed impressed too. Got a picture of herself in front of the weird sculpture and sent it home to her kids. There was no question, she said, that this site needed to be preserved. But then I pointed out to her the implications of this discovery. This was clear evidence of intelligent life on Wanasamata. It changed everything we thought we knew, and the deforestation program shouldn't go ahead until a more thorough survey could be carried out. Lita told me she'd take it on board, and then left, pointing out she was very busy. Chilwell seemed to think this was a good result, that we'd found something they couldn't ignore, and it would strengthen the argument for other sites. But I was afraid ALS were tending towards the opposite view. This small settlement fulfilled their obligations nicely. They could preserve it, and then do what they liked with the rest of the planet. So that night, I took matters into my own hands and messaged Braxiatel again. The next morning, I walked out of my quarters and was literally checking my messages on my way to the mess hall to see if he'd replied, when I looked up to find the man himself sitting at a table, eating a grapefruit, and reading the autumn 1959 issue of Man About Town magazine. On the floor next to his chair was a dark brown antique travelling case. "Good morning, Bernice," Brack said brightly. He seemed fresh as a daisy. "Hmm," I said. I got myself some coffee, porridge and melon from the machine, and ate these while I listened to what Brax had to say. He was already putting pressure on ALS to resurvey the planet and scale back their plans, and was pulling strings with some politicians he knew in the region. But in the meantime, he wanted to see this site for himself. Of course he did. As we were leaving, we passed Professor Chilwell coming the other way. He was visibly stunned that Braxiatel was here, and not just because he hadn't authorised any visitors. Watching him kowtow to Brax gave me mixed emotions. I did lose even more respect for him. But, on the other hand, he was visibly impressed that I had the power to summon Brax, and I rather enjoyed that. The last thing I said to Chilwell before Brax and I headed off was, "Let Lita know he's here." It was about an hour's journey in a flyer. We'd left some of our drones to guard the settlement. I noticed ALS had also left a drone, presumably not to guard, but to watch what we did. Brax and I both waved it a cheery good morning. I predicted Lita would drop by to see us before lunchtime, possibly with her boss, who hadn't yet deigned to meet me. When we entered the tower, Braxiatel put down his travelling case. Then he walked all around the sculpture at the centre. In my mind, I was still calling it a sculpture because that was my best guess. But I didn't say that out loud because I didn't want Brax to correct me. "Sculpture? Yes. I can see why you might think that, Bernice. But to the trained eye..." So I just kept quiet and watched him as he kept on walking around the thing. Eventually, he came back and stood next to me. "So, what is it?" I asked. Brax shrugged. "Some kind of sculpture, perhaps?" "Really?" I replied. "You sound disappointed," he said. No, I said. It's just that's exactly what I thought it was. And I was sort of hoping it was something weirder.
Would it cheer you up if I told you one weird thing about it? He said. Those pieces of glass, or whatever they are,
they don't reflect, I jumped in excitedly. They look like glass, but you can't see yourself in them, which suggests they're not glass.
Ah, you noticed that, Brax replied. But that's not what I was going to say. They're not held up by anything.
I had been wondering what was holding them up, but I didn't expect the answer to be nothing.
When I first saw them, I told him, I thought they looked like they were frozen in time.
Yes, Braxiatel said as he kneeled down and opened his travelling case. It was one of those ones that fans out into lots of compartments, and I was rather jealous. I'd always wanted one like that. He opened a couple of drawers, brought out some pieces of equipment I didn't remotely recognise. One was squarish and dark grey with a line of white numbers across the surface. The other was tubular and pale yellow. He switched them on and tapped one against the other. They both made the same bright tinkling sound, and the square thing started to pulse. Braxiatel handed it to me and asked me to tell him if the white numbers went above 1,000. Then he walked over to the sculpture and pointed the pale yellow thing at it. He walked all around the sculpture, putting the yellow thing very close to it, and then the numbers jumped above 1,000. In fact, even as I was telling Brax this, the numbers kept on going up very quickly, above 3,000. Brax quickly retreated and came back over to me.
Well, he said, this object has a unique relationship to time.
Gosh, I replied, you don't see a lot of those these days, do you?
The pieces literally are frozen in time, he went on, or possibly falling very, very slowly. I need to do more research.
He tapped the pale yellow thing against his teeth, and then he stopped, because we could both hear a loud noise coming from further up inside the tower. The vibration passed through the whole tower and the stone floor, and I instinctively put out my arms to steady myself. Braxiatel just pushed his hands into his pockets and tilted his head back. At the top of the tower, just before you reached the ceiling, there seemed to be a ring of stone, and it was slowly, grindingly rotating. The ring had a series of large holes cut into it, the same size as the ones I'd seen on the outside. Light started to filter into the tower as the two sets of holes lined up, and the angle of the holes set the light down onto the panes of the sculpture. The rotation stopped, and as we watched, images appeared across the panes of the sculpture. They looked like reflections, but they weren't reflections of anything that was in the tower or outside it. They were images of people and places. All kinds of people with all kinds of lives. We saw births, marriages and deaths. We saw great journeys and wars, euphoria and misery. We only saw them in flashes, but there were so many I didn't even know how long we stood there before the top of the tower rotated again and the light was shut out. I think even Braxiatel was stunned by what we'd seen. But after a while we started to talk about what it meant, and we'd both come to the same conclusion. The history of this place was stored in the sculpture, and letting the light on it released that history. But if that's right, I said, then not only was this world inhabited by intelligent life, it was pretty bloody busy. It looked like at least one civilization had risen and fallen here, possibly more. I wondered if it was a trading hub or something, but what surprised me was a lot of the species were familiar. Why wasn't their activity on this planet recorded anywhere? But these oddities only strengthened my conviction that we had to investigate further. And I told Brax, we had to get a protection order slapped on this planet as a matter of urgency. He nodded, but he was still looking at the sculpture.
Of course, you know how hard that can be. Mining companies will just appeal over and over again until you run out of money.
But you won't run out of money, I pointed out.
No, he replied, but if this sculpture is our main point of evidence, we can't trust them to leave it intact. We need to take it with us.
My initial response was to laugh.
What? I said.
but he was serious. Of course, the Braxiatel collection was home to larger and more unwieldy things than this, so it wasn't impossible for him to transport it there in its entirety.
But if it's part of the history of this planet, I'm not saying it has to become a permanent part of the collection, he replied, but preserving it must be our priority. Don't you agree?
The way he'd phrased the question made it hard not to agree. Maybe he was right. Maybe it was naive of me to think ALS would leave it alone. But at the same time, there was something in Braxiatel's eyes that worried me. It's the look he gets when he wants something and he's determined to get it. As predicted, Lita arrived at the site not long afterwards, and she did have the boss with her. His name was Cairns, and he was very friendly. After we told him what we'd seen and the ramifications of his activities on the planet, he paused for a moment, and then he went on being friendly. We tried to show them the images we'd seen in the panes, but we couldn't work out how to trigger the windows around the top. And when we tried to explain it to them as calmly as we could, we still sounded like maniacs. As Cairns left, he said we'd given him lots to think about. Once he was gone, Braxiatel said to me, "We can't afford to waste any time," and he opened up his travelling case again. The problem facing us was this. How do you move something you can't even touch? It sounds like one of those riddles with a very droll, smart-assed answer, doesn't it? Which would be fine if we knew what the droll, smart-assed answer was. The sculpture didn't seem to be surrounded by a force field or anything like that. Yet there was that strange resistance when you tried to touch it. I suggested to Brax that the sculpture didn't physically exist at all and was just a projection. That would explain why light didn't interact with it in a normal way. But he wasn't having any of it. He was convinced the problem lay in the sculpture's unique relationship to time, and if he could bring it into phase with time as we experienced it, he could move it. "But if you're right about the pieces being suspended in the air because they're suspended in time," I said, "doesn't that mean when you nudge it into phase, they all fall down and shatter into a million pieces?" "I have thought of that, Bernice," he said, and pointed me towards two things I'd thought were spotlights, which he'd set up on either side of the sculpture. He told me these would hold the sculpture in a gravitational field and prevent it from falling. "In any case, I don't think they're made of glass." I agreed, but just because they weren't made of glass didn't mean they wouldn't shatter. We had more visitors. Chilwell and the rest of the team came by to have a look, advance their own theories. I sensed Brax found their presence counterproductive, so I kept them busy by taking them outside and focusing their attention on the outbuildings and the tower itself. The good news was Chilwell was even more willing to be swayed by Brax than he was by his corporate employers. I wasn't sure how much use he'd be, but it was better having him with us than against us. Braxiatel worked on the problem for the rest of the day, becoming increasingly uncommunicative. He set up electrical fields around the sculpture. He sent different types of rays and waves through it. He studied the movement of air around it. I spent the day sitting in the shade of one of the outbuildings, writing messages to various institutions and associations, appealing for them to put pressure on ALS to stop their work here, and, more importantly, for the authorities in this sector to put a preservation order on the whole planet, even if only temporarily. I got Brax to look up from his work occasionally so he could co-sign the letters. In the evening I told him I was going back to camp, and it was clear he wasn't coming with me. That evening I had a few drinks with Chilwell. He seemed rueful. Although the discovery excited him, this had all turned out much more complicated than he was prepared to deal with. I felt I'd judged him a little harshly before. He'd done too many of these jobs. They'd ground him down. After the booze loosened him up a bit, he let me know he'd been tipped off by some friends that ALS was casting around for our replacements. If our application for a preservation order failed, we'd be off the job before he could lodge an appeal. We'd never be let anywhere near Wanasamata again. I realised this wasn't just important for the heritage of this planet, but also for the careers of everyone on the team, and I hope Brax realised it too. The next day, I went back to the tower, Abraxiatel was still at work. He didn't like to say it, but he was running out of ideas. I suggested the sculpture was actually defying his analysis and his efforts to affect it, essentially that it knew what he was doing.
Yes, he snapped. I have thought of that, Bernice.
All right, I said, and kept quiet for a moment.
Do you think it is, though?
Oh, possibly, possibly. He threw down his calculator and rubbed his brow.
But somehow it got here, and somehow it can be got out again. Please don't be flippant, he said.
And then he walked over to it and spoke in a low voice that I couldn't hear, but I could tell he was asking it nicely. But within minutes, a message arrived. A government panel was being convened tomorrow morning to consider our request. The arbitration process could take weeks, but while it was active, both sides had to leave the site as it was, so ALS wouldn't be able to do anything to the sculpture.
Legally, no, Braxiatel said. But it's hardly unknown for companies to covertly hire third parties to wreck things, making sure they have plausible deniability.
But we have to respect the process, I said. Otherwise, we can hardly expect them to. He sat on the stone floor for a couple of minutes, staring at the sculpture, and I thought he was just waiting for me to leave him alone. But suddenly he briskly said,
Yes, you're right,
packed up his equipment in his travelling case, and walked back to the door faster than I could catch up with him. I was late preparing our submission. I wanted to present it myself, but the panel wanted to see Chilwell because he was in charge. The next morning I woke far too early. It was still dark outside. I had a paranoid fear that ALS would have pulled some shenanigans overnight and the panel wouldn't convene and ALS were about to kick us all off the planet. I had to check in and make sure it was all still on course. It was. They were meeting at 7 a.m. local time. But by that time, I couldn't get back to sleep, so I got up and went for breakfast. I called in at Braxiatel's room on the way, assuming he'd be awake as usual. But Brax wasn't in his room. Perhaps he was already at breakfast, I thought. But no. I checked a few other places around the camp, but I already knew exactly where he was. If he was still tinkering with that sculpture when the 7 a.m. deadline came down, ALS would have a perfect excuse to call foul. I had to get out there and make sure he left well alone. I took a flyer out to the tower as the sun was rising, going over what I would say to Brax when I got there. I knew he was older than me and far more influential. I knew I needed his help. I knew it would be a mistake to piss him off, but I was still going to tear a strip off him for ignoring me. And I was going to tell him that, frankly, I felt that all along he'd been wanting to get this sculpture to the collection by hook or by crook, and when he did, I didn't trust him to give it up. By the time I got there, I had it all worked out, and as I walked through the door of the tower, I was already launching into my speech, figuring I'd get in before he had a chance to say anything. But he wasn't there. Suddenly, I felt rather silly. Was he back at camp after all? Was there somewhere I hadn't checked? Had he just gone out for a leisurely morning stroll? But then I noticed his travelling case stood on the stone floor near the sculpture. I knew he'd taken it with him when he left last night. I remember him packing it up. Now it was back, and it was open. His tools and instruments were scattered around. The gravity field was in place. It seemed as if Brax had been hard at work and had merely stepped out for a moment. I was just wondering if ALS would go as far as to accost him and physically drag him away when... The grinding began again. The circles lined up. The early morning light streamed in and the sculpture came to life again, just as it had 2 days ago. But this time, something was different. Instead of showing me snatches of different people's lives, the sculpture just displayed images of Braxiatel. On some he looked younger. On some he seemed just the way I knew him. In fact, I was in some of the images. I saw him working at the collection, travelling, making deals, making speeches, exerting influence. What came through in every image, however, was his love of objects. The artistry, the history contained within them, the way they spoke of the lives of the people who owned them before. It was a life lived through things. As the images flashed past, I increasingly felt as if the various Braxiatels were looking at me. They no longer seemed to be in their respective moments in the past. They seemed afraid, pleading, like they were trapped under glass. And then the sculpture disappeared. And the tower disappeared with it. I blinked, thinking it couldn't really have vanished. Maybe the flashing images had just made my eyes go funny, but no. I was in the middle of the forest. Braxiatel's travelling case was on the ground next to me, and hanging in the air where the sculpture had been, suspended by his own gravity beams, was the unconscious form of Irving Braxiatel. After I got him down from there, he slowly came round, but he didn't speak except to ask where he was. I explained he hadn't moved. The tower had. He seemed to take this in his stride, and was just too disorientated to argue. I gathered up his things in the travelling case, helped him to his feet, and took him back to the flyer. All the outbuildings had gone too. There was nothing in the clearing to suggest there had ever been anything there. Braxiatel didn't talk much on the flyer, or when we got back to camp. I'd never seen him so shaken. I had to contact the arbitration panel and explain what had happened. Our case had collapsed. We looked like idiots. Of course, ALS were triumphant and even accused me of faking the whole thing with Braxiatel's help. There seemed barely any point in defending myself. All I wanted was to get out of there, and that was all ALS wanted too. It wasn't until Braxiatel and I were on a shuttle service to the nearest interplanetary interchange that he suddenly spoke. "I think it took about a decade," he said. "To do what?" I said. "No, I mean it took a decade from me," he said. "The sculpture, I mean. It's hard to be exactly sure, because that's the nature of memory. But there's about 10 years I just can't remember." I straightened up in my seat. "Bloody hell," I said. "Why didn't you say sooner?" "At first I thought it was just the trauma," he replied. "Memory loss. But no, the sculpture took it. It collects them, I think. That's what we saw in those reflections." "So it was all just stolen memories?" I asked. "Yes," he replied. "I still don't know what it was or where it came from. It was just collecting them." That was years ago, and I know Braxiatel better now. But I've never mentioned his missing decade, and neither has he. I know it still troubles him. I know he has alerts set up for the tower in case it appears anywhere again. It must be out there somewhere. Though whether there's any way of getting back what it stole, I've no idea. But I decided that for Christmas I was going to get him the next best thing. I got hold of a nice wooden box for it, because I know he appreciates good packaging. When it was wrapped, it looked like a box of posh chocolates. "Merry Christmas, Brax," I said as we shared a bottle of sherry in his study on Christmas Eve. He unwrapped it and opened the box to find one of the learning modules we used here on the collection. He looked up at me, waiting for me to explain. "I did a bit of digging around," I told him. "Not the usual sort of digging around I do. I've been in touch with people you know, and people you used to know. Got them to upload their memories of you. And I've compiled old pictures and footage and assembled it all chronologically. It's not everything, of course. But who remembers everything?" Braxiatel looked down at the module. "My missing decade, eh? You must have gone to a lot of effort." "I had, but I pretended I hadn't." He nodded. "That's a very thoughtful gift, Bernice," he said as he closed the box and put it to one side. "Don't you want to know?" I asked. "It's not that I don't want to know," he replied, "but I don't know if I want to see myself as others see me."